Hey there, my leaders. Yes, you're wondering why there's no music right now. Well, that's because I'm about to introduce you to our live in-studio taping that we did on Wednesday, October 30th here in Colombia. Some of you weren't there, I noticed. That's okay. That's why we have the podcast, so you can listen to it. But we want to thank all of our friends that did come out to support us. And without further ado, here is our live taping from October 30th, our pre-election show with Meg Kinnard from the Associated Press and Mayon Schechter with South Carolina Public Radio. It was so much fun.
Thank you, guys.
Welcome to the South Carolina Lead and the This Week in South Carolina crossover episode here at SCTV Studios in Columbia. I'm Gavin Jackson. Joining me along with this wonderful crowd in studio for our pre-election 2024 show is Associated Press National Politics Reporter Meg Kinnard and South Carolina Public Radio's Mayon Schechter to discuss election 2024 up and down the ballot. Welcome to you both and welcome to our studio audience. Okay, everyone's feeling pretty excited with less than a week to go. How's everyone feeling? A little anxious? Yes, no, maybe? Okay. We're all just, I see a couple beers out there. So thank you all for being here. Thank you all for being here too. Meg, I want to start with you. We're going to start national, then work our way down the ballot here. You have been covering this race, the campaign cycle since, I don't know, when did it start? Can you remember when it started?
It started in 2021, actually. Yeah. So right after the last one, we started the 2024 cycle.
And I was going to say, the last live taping that we did was back in May of 2023. And we were talking about Nikki Haley and Senator Tim Scott, who was about to jump in the race. And now here we are, just days away from Election Day. We are in the closing arguments portion of this race. So kind of tell us about the final pitches that we've been hearing from former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris and who they're trying to sway at this point.
I mean, who they're trying to sway is actually the easier part of that to answer. It really is the seven battleground states that anybody who's been paying attention to the news at all related to the presidential campaign has heard about these seven states. Obviously, North Carolina to our north and Georgia very close by, and then some others in the east and Midwest and out west. Pennsylvania is really the state that's gotten the most attention. It's the one that both major candidates have visited the most. Mm. And even within that, there are certain counties that are considered to be more apt to swing from one side of the aisle to the other. And so really, it's not the only places that the candidates are visiting, but that really is part of what these campaigns see as make or break, perhaps, for their general election prospects. What we're hearing from the Trump campaign and the Harris campaign and the candidates themselves in their closing arguments in these last couple of days are really portraits of two different types of America that they see. A lot of what we've heard from Donald Trump in these closing days has been very similar to what he's been talking about on the campaign trail for months, portraying Kamala Harris, obviously, who's been part of the Biden administration, as at fault for what he sees are problems from the economy to immigration to just about every international or national issue. He blames her since she's been part of the administration. And he says, I've already been president. Think about what a great situation it was, economically speaking and otherwise, when I was in office. Don't you want to go back to that? What we've heard from Kamala Harris is warnings about what she sees are threats that could come in a second Trump administration and her commitment to being kind of the adult in the room when it comes to foreign policy for the United States government, but also talking about the economy and how things are actually doing better now under the Biden-Harris administration and how she would commit to keeping that momentum going. So it is, you know, what we would anticipate to hear from top of the ticket nominees, obviously a compare and contrast. But in this closing week, it kind of has been a reiteration of a lot of the messaging that we've heard all along. Mm-hmm.
And before we kind of talk about what they're talking about in these closing arguments, you have been in pretty much every swing state too, right?
All but one. I'd never made it to Nevada this time around, and that is something I will always regret.
Yeah, and that's because you are a national politics reporter. You're part of the DC Bureau with the AP. So even though you're based here in South Carolina, which
that's
we're
right.
fortunate to have, you get to go all over as well,
I do.
Better or for worse.
Lots of miles in my car, lots of airline miles, so maybe I can take a vacation after.
But Meg, you weren't in D.C. last night, but you watched Kamala Harris give her closing argument there on the ellipse. Has she done enough, you think, since she became the nominee in late July to really differentiate herself from President Joe Biden?
It's been very tough, I think. And obviously, when Kamala Harris, the first time on The View, was asked that question, what would you have done differently compared to Joe Biden? She said, I really can't think of anything. And that's the answer that's kind of followed her along, even though she has made some tweaks to it and said that she has come up with a few areas in which she would have maybe gone stronger or done a little bit of a pivot. Still, the fact that she said it that way has been kind of difficult for her to recover from. And it's certainly been something that Donald Trump and his allies have been reminding people about. But I think that what we heard from Vice President Harris last night was a little bit of the new generation spin that she's been trying to put forth. Clearly, she is a lot younger than Joe Biden, and that's part of why I think we're seeing her atop the ticket, given his departure from the race earlier this summer. But it's spinning forward. It's talking about, okay, so yes, we accomplished this during the Biden-Harris administration, but these are ways that I would like to further that progress. So it was kind of a little bit more of a forward look than perhaps we've heard during some of her earlier stump speeches.
Yeah, that to-do list versus a grievance list.
Exactly. What she said Donald Trump would do is he's going to be trying to get with his enemies, whereas she's going to come into office with a list of things she wants to accomplish.
And pivoting to Trump here, you watch a lot of his speeches. I don't think people realize that when it comes to, you know, how the Associated Press covers the presidential campaign, y'all have someone usually on the ground watching these speeches, but then folks back home watching from wherever they are, just so they can kind of pick up on anything that someone who's out in the crowd, when you're surrounded by a lot of different things, a lot of stimuli, you might have missed.
So you and hear, also, like, you can't really connect here, to anything, as we've all been there with our cell phones and laptops not working.
And people
working.
Are yelling at you. You know, they
don't. It can be a little chaotic, so it's a lot easier to have someone backstopping you on a live stream.
So that being said, you watch a lot of those. You continue to hear this policy versus personality when it comes to former President Trump, but it doesn't always seem like that. In fact, he doesn't always stay on message, much to Senator Lindsey Graham's chagrin. We see him on the Sunday morning shows really trying to focus that message. So we also looked at the former President Trump's big rally there at Madison Square Garden over the weekend, where he laid out more grievances than anything else. So how is that working when it comes to what we're hearing from President Trump?
In terms of what we heard at the Madison Square Garden event, which was intended to be his closing argument on Sunday night, a lot of it was overshadowed almost immediately by something that not Donald Trump said, but one of the comedians who was introducing him, referring to Puerto Rico as an island of garbage. That was the entire next news cycle, which is still bleeding into further news cycles. And so that detracted from some of what Donald Trump was talking about. In that speech, we did hear a lot of the similar type stuff, although perhaps delivered in a little bit different manner. There was a lot of nostalgia for this moment for Donald Trump in his hometown. Obviously, he doesn't expect to really win the state of New York, I don't think. It was more of a national attention moment. But he was still talking about what he sees as flaws in Kamala Harris and her proposals, the dangers that he warns about in terms of security along the U.S.-Mexico border. He was still hitting a lot of the same issues that he talks about, but it was kind of trying to package it in this feel-good sort of moment that, unfortunately, he did not get that next news cycle because of the comedian.
But if you're his supporters, if you're his campaign, aren't you really trying to get more folks? And do you think that that kind of language, that kind of, you know, here's how I've been aggrieved, you know, here's what I'm mad about, here's how we're going to make things better, but not really give too many details. Isn't there a better way to maybe bring more people in versus maybe coming across as negative?
It's a good question. A lot of consultants analyze this, and they look at how Donald Trump is speaking on the stump and saying a lot of the things you just mentioned, and they're like, he's really just talking to his base. He's talking to the people who already support him. He's not really going after those swing voters or those Pennsylvania counties that, you know, really are kind of at stake in terms of the undecided voters, because I think a lot of us would go and talk to people, our friends and neighbors. I mean, most people have made up their minds by this point. There aren't a whole lot of folks who are completely unaware of who they're going to pick, whether, you know, they're already voting now or who they're going to pick on Tuesday. But it is up to surrogates like Lindsey Graham sometimes to go out on the Sunday shows and to do other media interviews and try to, like, really get into the policy that when Donald Trump is on the stump kind of weaving this message, he talks about it as a weave of stories together that he's not necessarily hitting on specifically. So they have to kind of go and reiterate some of those points.
And of course, South Carolina is not one of those seven swing states that we're talking about, but we are wedged between two of them.
Right in the middle.
We're that little tomato. But, you know, we're taping this episode on Wednesday, October 30th, and today both candidates were in North Carolina making those arguments. And when you start looking at the polls and electoral math, Meg, there have been a lot of curveballs in this election, to say the least, but one big one in North Carolina has been down ballot in that turmoil, including the fallout with Republican Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson's past post to a pornographic website as he runs for governor, and then some disturbing past rhetoric from that Republican candidate for the school superintendent race. So based on your time in North Carolina, which you've covered a lot of the campaign trail in, do you think that that might move the needle when it comes to how North Carolina goes? Obviously, Joe Biden did not win North Carolina, but it was very narrow, and the Democrats are really trying to get something there too. And they always split the ticket there in North Carolina, it seems like. So could this turmoil plus maybe some recent comments change things?
It is very interesting to look at a state like North Carolina that currently has a Democratic governor. And clearly there is a governor's race going on, but they have a Democrat in that office, but yet they're very much in play for Republicans for presidential election. South Carolina, clearly we haven't had that circumstance in quite some time. But when I talk to voters in North Carolina about Mark Robinson, asking about these allegations against him, I have yet to meet someone who is really concerned enough about them to think about not supporting Donald Trump over it and not supporting Mark Robinson over it. Frankly, it doesn't really seem to make a big difference to them, even in the governor's race. Granted, these are people I'm talking to generally at events for former President Donald Trump, so you can kind of telegraph to see where they might be feeling. But all in all, this, you're absolutely right. North Carolina is a place where both the Harris campaign and the Trump campaign have been spending time, spending a lot of money and resources. We're seeing all kinds of ads. I can't tell you how many I heard and saw every time that I've been in that state over the past couple of weeks and months. So it is interesting to see our northern neighbor get so much attention, even though a Democrat hasn't carried that state since Barack Obama did in 2008 in the presidential election. And, you know, yet again, it's to see both campaigns seeing it as enough of a possibility where they're really going to be spending all this time and focusing on it. That is definitely interesting. And I think it's going to come down to the wire there.
Yeah, there'll be a lot to watch for North Carolina, too, up and down the ballot like we're talking about. We have a couple more minutes with you, Meg, before we jump to my own. But I want to ask about Nikki Haley, our former governor, former Republican presidential candidate. We were both on the campaign trail covering her extensively. But you just wrote about her again. We have a couple days left here in the campaign, and we haven't seen her on the trail outside of the RNC when we were both up there. All of us were up there in Milwaukee for that and our fun journey back.
So fun.
Tell us about the state of play there when it comes to Haley and her relationship with the Trump campaign at this point.
Nikki Haley says that she hasn't spoken with Donald Trump since June, and we are now in almost November. So you can do the math, and that was quite a while ago, even before the Republican National Convention. So that tells you they did not speak while they were both in the same space and she was advocating for him. But what from what Nikki Haley and her team are telling me is they have made it very clear to the Trump campaign and to Donald Trump that she is available, that she obviously is the Republican who got next to him the most votes in the whole primary. She stuck with it longer than any of the other candidates. So purportedly, there were a lot of voters, even after she left the race, who were continuing to vote for her in primaries and caucuses that followed. Mm-hmm. Whether that's a protest vote or whether that's people who really saw themselves as more aligned with her and wanted to participate in that Republican primary, that is of note. And so for Donald Trump not to have reached out to her, it's funny, it actually benefits Nikki Haley. Sure, she gets credit for coming out and saying, I support my party's nominee. I do not support Kamala Harris. I appreciate a lot of the Harris people who are now trying to go after those voters who supported me, Nikki Haley, in the primaries, but I don't support her. But it benefits Nikki Haley because if she has future political aspirations of her own, she still gets that credit for saying, I support my party's nominee, but also not appearing with him on the trail, given that he is such a polarizing figure even within the Republican Party, could actually better serve her on her own if she chooses to run for the presidency again or seek some other office. That's not something that she is directly telling me, but having covered South Carolina and having covered Nikki Haley as long as we have, I think we all know that there is typically a look at what's next and what's to come. So we'll see. Yeah. Maybe you heard it here first. Maybe it never happens. But
well, I mean, it's like when I asked her right before the primary in February, you know, is this just a part of you setting up a future run saying, I told you so, if at the time Joe Biden wins, but now if Kamala Harris wins, as she kind of predicted was going to be the case.
She certainly did multiple times over and over.
We'll see after November 5th or whenever we get the election results.
Whenever it's over.
But Meg, wrapping up here, Haley got picked in Trump's first term as a thank you to then Lieutenant Governor Henry McMaster, who endorsed Trump early on. Could we see some potential South Carolinians jumping into a Trump cabinet again?
I think it's very possible. A name that comes up all the time is Tim Scott, who clearly was in the presidential race for about 6 months himself, but then has become one of Donald Trump's big surrogates. He was stumping in some of those other early states, not just our home state of South Carolina. He's been out on the trail. He's still out on the trail campaigning for him. And he often gets mentioned in terms of a financial related appointment, maybe because of his service on the Senate Banking Committee. So I think it's very possible that we would see him being considered for that. Lindsey Graham's name also comes up a lot. Obviously, he is a senator and has been serving in the Senate for some time representing South Carolina. He is another of Donald Trump's big surrogates and supporters going back to that 2016 race after he dropped out himself, of course. So I think that's another possibility. But if either one of those things happen, or if they both were to happen, we would have two open Senate seats here in South Carolina, the appointment of which would be up to who? Governor Henry McMaster. who is also a major Trump backer and surrogate. So that's just all kinds of ways that a potential Trump administration could affect our home state, even though we aren't one of those seven battlegrounds. And that'll be something that we're watching super carefully.
You can definitely last longer as a senator for 6 years versus being in the Trump administration. You never know how long that's going to last.
And South Carolina is known for having longevity in our senators, so there's also that term.
But segue us into my own and talking about Congress and looking at what you think might happen based on the top of the ticket and how that could affect what could happen in the control of Congress, Meg.
It's very interesting for people like us to think about how these two things work together, because thinking about which presidential administration you get, if they have a Congress that they can work with or not, depending on who's controlling the House or the Senate or both, or, you know, if the president doesn't have either, that could be a tricky situation. In South Carolina, I don't think that we're going to be seeing a lot of differences and surprises in our races here. But I think that if we do have a Democratic administration, we may end up seeing one of those circumstances where the Republican representatives from South Carolina are frequently finding themselves at odds and having a lot of grievances with a Democratic administration in the White House. We have seen that. I think that would continue. If there's a Republican in the White House, there are a lot of Republicans who have supported Donald Trump in our current delegation who will likely be in the next iteration of that delegation. And so there could be some opportunities for projects to come back to South Carolina for sure, but also to have some of those members highlighted as they are out there supporting Donald Trump if he's elected.
So we're nice, well situated here in South Carolina.
There's always something going on in South Carolina, for sure.
Thank you, Meg. But when it comes to the balance of Congress, no, that hinges, like Meg was saying, on our state because it's pretty well set. I don't want to ruin any surprises for November 5th, but based on gerrymandering and how the districts are drawn, it's pretty much ideological where it's going to go based on how things are drawn right now. But there will be a new face in our delegation following the election in the Republican-controlled 3rd District, if it goes as we expect it to, because it's such a conservative district. And that's Sherry Biggs, who narrowly beat that firebrand pastor Mark Burns, who's been in South Carolina politics or tangential to it for some time. And she won by 1,100 votes in that primary. We always talk about primaries really being the big decider when it comes to who's going to be on that November ballot, but that's when you really get your voice heard if you're in one of these districts and you feel like you can't make a change. Look into the June primary. But what's going on in the 3rd District, Mayon?
Right. I mean, exactly as you mentioned, party primaries are where, as everyone knows, I think, where races get decided in South Carolina for the most part. Sherry Biggs, while not really known super statewide, is known in Republican circles. She and her husband have been big time donors and their allies to Henry McMaster for a very long time. We didn't really get a whole lot of time to talk to her when we were in Milwaukee, but Republicans that I've talked to say she is very nice, very easygoing, will be a good fit in the delegation. Of course, as we know, Congressman Jeff Duncan decided not to run. He is going through a divorce, had some very public allegations of infidelity, and so that was not working with his district. She is pretty well-funded on her own, but she's a well-funded candidate. Again, this is an upstate district, and as you mentioned, if maybe Mark Burns had won the primary, maybe we would be having perhaps a slightly different conversation. I don't think a wildly different conversation. Mm-hmm. It's a tough district for Democrats to win, and especially after this redistricting process, it's even tougher. So she is going to be our second Republican congresswoman from South Carolina with Nancy Mace, of course. And we'll see how she does. But she is on her way to being the next congresswoman from South Carolina.
Yeah, and when those seats open up like it did with Jeff Duncan, people really pounce on them because they don't turn over very often. And when you get it, unless you really mess up, it seems like it's kind of on cruise control for the most part. You vote no if you want to, you vote yes if you want to. And
incumbency is very strong, and it's hard to beat in South Carolina.
But in the 4th district right over there, the Greenville-Spartanburg district, we did see incumbent Congressman William Timmons have a very bruising primary in June between him and Adam Morgan, the House Freedom Caucus here in the State House. But again, that's another very strong conservative district. It went by 20 points in 2020 for Trump. So hate to say for Catherine Harvey, but we don't expect a very big surprise here. So what's the latest on that district and what you expect to see? Because there has been some, you know, some interaction there on the campaign trail.
Right. I actually think that Catherine Harvey, she's the chairwoman of the Spartanburg County Democratic Party, despite the fact that, again, she is a Democrat in a conservative district. She has run what I think has been a much better campaign, a bit more of an aggressive campaign than we've seen from a lot of Democrats running in that district. She is. She talked to us when we were in Chicago for the DNC about how they have been reaching out to voters who did not, who were not active in past election cycles. I think there were some 6,000, which of course is not a crazy big number, but can make a difference for down ballot, as we're talking about down ballot races. You know, what I am interested with that race is, you know, Spartanburg, Greenville area. Does she bring out voters who maybe didn't vote in the midterms or even in the past general to help vote for some of these down ballot races, state house, local races, things like that? So despite the fact that, again, uphill battle for a Democrat to win that one, maybe she's able to help turn out voters for other local races.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what we're, especially in a presidential election year versus the midterms when Sally really does drop off. But the closest competition is always in the first congressional district down there in the low country on the coast in Charleston, down to Hilton Head, with Congresswoman Nancy Mace, who flipped that district red by 1.3 points back when she was first elected in 2020. That was also when the district went by 6 points for Donald Trump. She faces off against Democrat Michael B. Moore. Now, Mace easily won her second term by defeating Democrat Annie Andrews by 14 points in 2022. What can we expect here?
Yeah, this is a district that perhaps was a bit more competitive in previous cycles, and the U.S. Supreme Court has kind of ended that a bit. They upheld the map that the Republican-controlled legislature drew, and that was over a lawsuit, of course, where black voters in that district felt that they were disenfranchised the way that the legislature carved it all up. I mean, they basically moved Charleston completely out of the district and into the 6th district with Jim Clyburn. And so vastly, obviously, different areas. So yeah, she's in a very, very good situation. I saw some reporting last week or maybe over the weekend that talked about how she's been running a bit quieter of a campaign and, you know, she's not worried. I would argue with the word quiet. I'd probably fight a little bit over that because I think she's
depending
been pretty,
on what social media account you're on,
active.
What cable news channel, yeah.
And she's been very active within the Charleston County Sheriff's race. But yes, in the traditional sense, I think Nancy Mace has probably not been doing, like, you know, not creating a lot of new ads, maybe not doing like the traditional door knocking stuff that maybe people would do when they're in situations that are a bit more precarious. So clearly she feels very, very comfortable walking into Election Day.
Yeah, she had a little bit of a primary there too, but she easily won outright. We have about 5 minutes left and I want to get to the state house first, but a question that we always get from the audience that we're going to preempt right now is talking about, will this ever change? And when we look at Democratic Congressman Jim Clyburn's 6th district, that's the only one that ever goes all Democratic. Trump has won all the other districts in the state. We just mentioned the 1st, 3rd, and 4th, but there's also Congressman Joe Wilson in the 2nd, Congressman Ralph Norman in the 5th, and then Congressman Russell Fry in the 7th out there on the Grand Strand of the PD. All three of them are expected to easily defeat their Democratic and third party challengers, and this is because we're talking about how these maps are drawn in the Republican-controlled state house. So, Mayon, several people have asked us about this, as we've always talked about, but based on population growth and voting trends, we're not going purple anytime soon like our neighbors.
Yeah, I mean, I think you pretty much answered it. The people that are moving to South Carolina are traditionally more Republican voters. They're older. You mentioned the 1st District, the 5th District, York County area. Then there's the 7th District on that Myrtle Beach, Horry County. I mean, those are fast-growing areas of the state, and they're not trending toward the center, and are not really trending toward the left either. You were talking to Drew McKissick, the chairman of the Republican Party, the other day, and Drew was telling you about how they can literally track voters now. They have the software, the program, the data to track voters where they can see how they voted in past elections from other states. Mm-hmm. And he said the voters that they see coming in are traditional Republican voters. And so, yeah, do I think anything's going to change, you know, in the next cycle? I'm not really sure. Maybe we're going to get another
district.
Yeah, maybe we see something like that. But, you know, right now, I don't think so.
So let's go to the State House, Maya. And we were talking about Drew, and he was on the show talking about how they expect to flip two House and two Senate seats. He wouldn't say which ones. How exciting for all of us. But we talk about that. You know, what do you see at play when it comes to these numbers, when it comes to, you know, 30 Republicans in the Senate, 87 Republicans in the House, and they're on the verge of getting a supermajority like they have in the House, but over in the Senate. So where do you see some of the big races, the possible big flips happening?
Yeah, we say every election cycle, this is the most important election. I think if you're a Democrat, this is the most, every election cycle is the most important. So just as background, you've heard me say this 100 times. In 2020, Democrats lost 5 seats in the state house in the 2022 midterms. And then, by the way, that was at the time, and I almost forgot, where we had a massive U.S. Senate race between Lindsey Graham and Jamie Harrison. Yeah. Democrats thought they were going to get a huge turnout. They did, just not in their favor. Then in 2022, Democrats lost more seats in the House, even seats that really they had no business losing, seats that Joe Biden had won in 2020. So when we were at a Get Out the Vote event the other day in Columbia, Crystal Swain, the chairwoman of the South Carolina Democratic Party, talked about how, what does victory look like on election day? It looks like them defending the incumbents. And that's huge. And that's simple in words, not simple in how it may work out because of the way that we are going to have turnout. But yeah, if we're talking about here, especially in the Midlands, I think is in the House, House District 75, that race, that's between incumbent Democratic lawmaker Heather Bauer, and she is facing off against the former representative of that seat, Kirkman Finley, who's a well-known name. That's one that is the swingiest district that we have in Richland County and is very close. We have some Senate races, who's going to succeed longtime Senator Nikki Setzler, Democrat from Lexington County. That's a race between GOP challenger Jason Gary and Russell Ott, who's a House Democratic lawmaker, of course. There are races in Clarendon County and Sumter County, in Darlington County. I mean, I don't know which races Drew McKissick is talking about, but now remember in 2020, we thought maybe Republicans would pick up at least one seat. We didn't think that they would pick up three seats in the Senate. And so even though they say two seats, it could be more.
And Mayon, we have about 30 seconds left, and you did a great job getting through all this. But record turnout right now, early voting turnout, we're probably going to reach more than 1 million, obviously. But how do you see that? What are we looking at right now, October 30th?
Yeah, more than 1 million people have already turned out to vote, plus absentee voters even higher. I think we could probably see higher than that number even on Election Day. We had 2 million something voters turn out in the 2022 midterms, somewhere in that area in 2020. I mean, I think we could be on the verge of surpassing both of those numbers. We've just seen, obviously, a voting base that's very electrified to show up this election.
That's AP National Politics Reporter Meg Kinnard and South Carolina Public Radio Reporter Mayon Schechter. Thank you all very much. Okay, so we're still on, and say hello to our online audience and all of our viewers from around the world who are watching tonight, as they say. I did have some extra questions, and we do have some all of your viewer questions, too. We cannot get to all of them because some of them we just can't get to anyway. But Meg, I wanted to ask a little bit more about, you know, just how results come in. We always talk about this. It's an easy way for people to, some people get apprehensive about, oh, it's taking so long and why haven't people called the race? The Associated Press, we all rely on for them to call the race. So if you could walk us through that process and, you know, maybe some words of wisdom when it comes to why is it taking so long?
Be prepared for a long night. That's what I've been told, and that's what I think we all can expect, given a lot of what Mayon was talking about in terms of early vote turnout. That's great, and you would think, oh, that's going to make it a lot easier because we've already got these votes in. Each state has their own rules, obviously, about how voting happens and how votes are counted. And in a lot of places, you can't start counting those early votes, which probably came in pieces of paper. Can't open those until either voting has started on Election Day or voting has ended on Election Day. And so that can mean for a very long night. But at least for the AP, yes, we've been calling races across the country since 1848. So there was a presidential election of Zachary Taylor was actually the first one that we called. And we started doing it because the government really wasn't, and news organizations kind of decided on their own, okay, well, people would like to know before y'all get around to it, like we can start also tabulating. And as a result, the AP essentially has a year-round group of people. We employ 4,000 people across the country to go to voting centers, polling places, county level organizations. Yeah, Mayon's got experience.
Thank you for your service.
But we gather those votes and start tabulating them ourselves so that we can then therefore call races. Mm-hmm. But that also does take a long time because for the AP, we don't make projections like you'll see on television sometimes where it's like this network projects that this person's gonna win. We don't do that. We don't call a race until we determine that the trailing candidate cannot mathematically overtake the leading candidate. And whenever that point is, when we get to that, that's when we call the race for this winner. And in 2020, I believe our accuracy was 99.99% in all of the calls that we made. Thank you.
On behalf of the organization,
yes,
thank you.
I do not call any of these races, but I will pass along the congratulations. Yeah. So yes, that's how we do it, but it can be a very lengthy night, and especially in a lot of these battleground places like we were talking about, where the vote totals are really impossible to tell at this point and expected to be very, very tight. There will be a lot of challenges. There are a lot of automatic recount rules in a lot of places, so we won't know the results there anyway. And when that happens for places like the AP, we won't call that race if it's already within that margin and we know a recount is coming. We'll just, you know, kind of keep our powder dry because, I mean, why rush into something when it's that unknown? Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a long night and maybe a long week. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. AT wanted me to start the show by saying that we already called Donald Trump for South Carolina, which, I mean, I don't want to let the cat out of the bag,
but Associated Press has not made that call.
Mayan, we were talking about the statehouse races, and I was going to ask you what you kind of see happening should, you know, Drew flip those seats and the Republican Party pick up some seats. What do you see happening when it comes to when lawmakers get back into Columbia that second Tuesday in January? Are we going to see maybe abortion come up? Do you think we're going to see more conservative bills making it through easier through the state house?
Yeah, I mean, the reality already is that because Republicans control both the House and the Senate, that, you know, Democrats were kind of a bit on the losing end. They didn't really need Democratic support on a lot of legislation. Not to say that they don't work with Democrats, because plenty of Republicans do work with Democrats on things like the budget, other legislation. But I was looking back at my previous articles. In 2020, after that election, Republicans were talking about wanting to take up abortion, guns, private school vouchers or educational scholarship accounts, whatever you want to call them. And they did. In the past 4 years, I mean, they have taken up all of those items. I think that we already do know, right, that after the state Supreme Court overturned the state's private school voucher law, that Republicans, especially in the Senate, in both chambers, want to take that issue back up, and they believe that that will be a priority, especially given now that the state Supreme Court looks different. Having now covered the state house for, I can't remember, it's been like half of the time that I've lived in the state at this point, I think they've taken up a bill related to abortion access every single year.
And you sound like Jeffrey Collins now.
I'd be shocked if they didn't. Someone's going to talk about it at least. I do think that we'll probably see more conservative legislation. I think especially, you know, the Senate races are really interesting to watch, because the House, a lot of House Republicans have long complained that bills, and the House, chucks out bills all the time. The House has long complained that their bills get into the Senate and they just sit there and die. You know, the Senate's known as being like the deliberative body. They slow down legislation, which is frankly not always the worst thing in the world. But if Republicans are able to pick up more seats and they're able to tilt that chamber a bit more to the conservative side, then perhaps some of the bills that are getting out of the House we'll see actually pass in the Senate. So I'm always surprised by what the legislature does. Some years, you know, it's not a surprise, but I do think the voucher law, the educational scholarship accounts, again, whatever you'd like to call that, I do think that will come up, and probably if there is a bill, we'll pass this session.
Yeah, we can see some leadership shake up in the Senate too. We haven't, you know, Shane Massey's on the fence about if he's still going to be leading the Republicans in there or not, but hard to say.
Right. I mean, that's obviously a chamber that's still, as you know, I both know, run by seniority, and so I think some of the old guard will, I mean, for the most part, right, will still be there, but we're going to have a lot of new freshmen. And, you know, there used to be this saying by one senator that, like, freshmen should show up and just sit in the back and be quiet. And that really hasn't proven to be the case, I feel like, in the last couple of years. Or in Congress, yeah. So I do think that perhaps we'll just see a lot more activity moving forward. We've already seen that in the House.
Gotcha. And then I just want to ask you guys generally just kind of a little bit of a vibe check here, what you're picking up on maybe talking to voters, because now it's unlike going to a rally where everyone is like really choosing to be there. Yes, folks are choosing to vote, but everyone, you know, more people vote than go to rallies. And so it's a little bit more impassioned versus folks doing their constitutional right there. But talking to voters, what are you picking up on, Meg? What are you hearing from people? Are they anxious? Are they excited? What have you heard so far?
I think there's a mix of both of those sentiments for sure. People are glad that this is finally happening and is almost over, I think. I feel a lot of that from voters on all sides of the spectrum. Especially in those battleground states that I was talking about, TV ads, radio ads, YouTube, like it is just, remember the 2020 Senate race here where it's like you can't turn on your computer without seeing like Jamie Harrison and Lindsey Graham, like they are dealing with that on the presidential level absolutely every single day. And so in battleground states, voters are just ready to have this be done. But I think there is a lot of enthusiasm, certainly, as we're seeing in all of these early vote totals of people just going ahead and doing it.
Yeah.
And I think in large part, we're seeing that particularly as compared to 2020 this time, because Republicans have embraced the notion of early voting. There's still some skepticism and there's still some issues that some would argue are present in early voting as opposed to voting on the day. But at every single one of his rallies, Donald Trump has been telling his supporters to get out and vote early, if at all possible. And that is the opposite of what we heard in 2020. I'm not saying, and I'm not telegraphing, that all of these early votes are coming from one side or the other, but I do think that that's probably just contributing to seeing more and more. I do think that there is a lot of anxiety, though. I've talked to plenty of people who are enthusiastic to go ahead and make their own selections, and they're glad to do it, but they're still worried. And this is from both sides of the spectrum, not necessarily people who support one candidate or the other. You know, because a lot of these folks who are going ahead and doing it early are so excited and participatory in the process, but also they're doing that in part because they do have even a more heightened sense of anxiety of what happens if the other side, whichever side that is, wins. And so, you know, we'll see how this all pans out on November 5th or 6th or 7th or 8th or, I'm sorry, whatever day it's actually over and done with. But yeah, it's kind of a broad range of the entire spectrum of emotions, I think, for voters.
Yeah, because the 2020 race wasn't called until the Saturday after.
It was the Saturday afterward. And so that's kind of, in part, that's what I base a little bit of the thinking about. I mean, I have absolutely no idea. I play no role in that when it comes to what the AP does. But in 2020, we did have an awful lot of early voting and voting by mail, obviously because of the pandemic. And so when we think about kind of the structures of voting as it happens now, just about every place has early voting. Even if they were struggling to figure out how to do it in 2020, they're definitely doing it now and maybe have a better system set up, but that still could mean for some delays in terms of how we tabulate everything.
Yeah, and Mayon, like the anxiety, comparing it to 2020, in other elections. I mean, it's just really so much more present now than we've seen in the past, it seems like.
I mean, I agree with everything that Meg said. I think that has been the same case when I've talked to voters and when you've talked to voters. We both spent a significant amount of time in Lexington County.
I love it. Oh my gosh,
over
it's
the last
wild
week.
Over there.
And yeah, and it was really actually, it was very
interesting. I'm going back tomorrow.
Right.
I can't get enough. Actually, I'm going to Wahala tomorrow.
Yeah.
That's not
Wahala.
Hopefully a much better parking situation than in Lexington County. But, you know, we both had the same experience. It was kind of interesting. You know, normally, like, when people are showing up, especially for early voting, you think, like, oh, everybody's just going to be so out about who they're voting for and what they care about.
And down the ballot,
and
like, tell me
ballot.
About why you voted for the State House.
Yeah.
And they're just like, I just voted straight ticket.
Right. But, you know, we dealt with a lot of voters who didn't want to talk about who they were voting for. And, I don't, you know, you never know which way that kind of goes. I mean, there are obviously some people online that were very clear about who they were voting for. By, you know, the apparel that they were going to be told to take off by the time they walked inside.
Turn your shirt inside out.
Or the hat that they put over the hat is what I talked to.
But we talked to a lot of folks who just didn't want to talk about it, which I thought was so interesting, especially on the first day of early voting, because to me, those are perhaps the most enthusiastic voters. But it was kind of quiet. So, you know,
It was a little depressing when people were like, I don't want to share my opinion. I'm like, okay, like, obviously, we're in such a polarized place right now that anything can become viral in a matter of seconds. Mm-hmm. And so people are terrified of, like, you know, even expressing a joke.
Mm-hmm.
So I get that. But then at the same time, a little bit of you kind of dies thinking, oh, we don't want to have social discourse anymore in our country because of that fear.
It's hard. Yeah. I get it.
So that being said, I have some of the viewer questions here. And I'm
going to
just go through some of these. Someone says, I would like your opinion on Donald Trump. We're not going to give any opinions, unfortunately.
No, we're not doing
that's
that.
Not, We are not the opinion page.
We are objective journalists.
Yeah, that's the difference there between, you know, we could talk about the opinion page versus the other part of the newsroom.
I also don't want
to. You know, we don't need to go to the Washington Post situation there either.
No.
What do you think of Harris? I can't tell you that. Why do villains have such strong following? I can't really get into psychology.
Not on land.
Only at sea.
Only at sea.
Meg, this is just a kind of very general question. How likely is it that we'll ever get rid of the Electoral College?
Ooh, that's a great one. I was actually having a very in-depth conversation about the Electoral College with my 13-year-old yesterday on the way to school. She's very pro. Just in case.
Well, she can't vote, so it doesn't matter.
She can't vote, yeah, so it really doesn't matter. This question comes up every year or every 2 years or every presidential cycle, certainly. And my gut on it is that I think it is here to stay. Mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of people who make arguments as to why we should get rid of it. At this point, I don't think that there are enough of those people to really formatively change it because, I mean, sure, the United States makes some tweaks and differences to the way that we run things, the way that, you know, we certainly pick apart parts of government or add things or subtract things, and some of that's court-made law and some of that's legislative or whatever. But the Electoral College is so formative in terms of how we are structured as a country and how we select our next layer of leadership. I don't think that's going to be changing. I do put a caveat on that, though, that I do hear about it more and more, particularly when we come to these presidential cycles and the knowledge that there hasn't been a Republican who has carried the popular vote. Even when that candidate has won the electoral vote, mm-hmm. that there's been that difference. And I think that's always when we have the biggest schism in an election, because it's the electoral votes that matter, but the popular vote, I mean, this happens, you know, a Democrat will win the popular vote.
It's also like D.C. statehood stuff, too.
It is, and so it just, the conversation does come back around every single time, and I just feel like the longer that track record lasts, that even though there have been Republicans elected president, but they also haven't carried the popular vote, the longer that there is that difference, I think the conversation will continue. And I'm not like necessarily forecasting like, okay, so if that happens this time, then in 4 years, it's gone. Like, no, that is not it at all. But I do think the conversation will certainly be sticking around, as will the Electoral College for this moment.
Gotcha. Someone asked, what do you think will be one surprise, if anyone wants to guess about that? No, you don't want to do that. Here's one that you can answer,
Meg. We have October for one more day. The October surprise thing. Like, it always is a thing, but we only have one more day. So if we can get past it, then we don't have enough.
Speaking of November 5th, how quickly do you expect the 2026 and 2028 campaigning to start in South Carolina?
Already.
Oh, it's already started.
Ro Khanna has been here a few times already.
It is already happening. It has been happening all year long, I would say. We at the AP, we have a little identifier on our stories called our slug line, and it is election 2024 for everything we're doing for the presidential election. We have already used election 2028 multiple times. I'm sorry, but we have.
Okay, some of these are pretty pointed, so.
So let's definitely get into that.
I have a question for all three of you.
Oh, God.
We're like, okay, so election day is Tuesday, right?
Oh, man.
Tuesday, okay? And then it's not going to end, right? Then it's just going to start the worst part of that week, you know?
Yes.
So what are you guys going to do to find those moments of zen?
In that
chaos of post the 5th?
I have an answer. I actually worked on this today. As Gavin mentioned, I will be in Washington as part of AP's coverage there. I'm anchoring our live stream, which is going to be going on. Stop it. You just got asked a question about your podcast, which is actually Gavin's podcast because his father gave it to him.
It's his dad's podcast, canonically.
Anyway, but I'll be in D.C. and I'm doing a lot of stuff up there. But my boss advised me not to book a ticket home because he said we don't know when the voters will decide that you can
really
go
nice
home.
It was really nice seeing you.
Yeah, so it's great to be here. Thanks so much. But today, as part of my packing and preparation for being gone for I went to CVS, and Gavin will appreciate this because we've spent a lot of time on the campaign trail together. I got myself not one, not two, but three travel candles.
Oh.
This is my...
What is a travel candle?
A travel candle is a candle, A, that has a lid, so you can travel with it and know that your wax, even if it happens to get warm in transit, is not going to get everywhere. But it's also something to make your hotel room, which is your home away from home if you are me and literally live in hotels and on planes for the past 6 months, smell nice, because not all hotels smell nice. Mm-hmm. And it's also a moment of zen. Mm-hmm. One of my candles is called Calm.
I was going to ask for a power ranking of
one
the candles.
One of them is called Me Time. Mm. The other one is like Timber Woods or something. Let's, I don't know.
I thought it was just candle.
Yeah. But all of that goes to say, I do travel a lot, and I spend a lot of time really trying to unwind after a day of being on a press riser, in a scrum, on an airplane, whatever. And for me, it is those little things like buying good skincare just to make myself feel better, or having a nice candle, or, you know, just turning on a really stupid show on a streaming service. Those are the ways that I try to keep a little sanity in mm-hmm. this little bit insane time. So those are my plans. My three travel candles.
Yeah.
We are going to make it.
From CVS, nonetheless. I feel bad. I should get you something better.
You're really a terrible friend.
It also, like, it's very luxurious to have a lit candle in a hotel room, but it also stresses me out.
Open flame in a candle.
Yeah, scary. Don't, like, out me to, like, Bonvoy.
There's no cats jumping around.
Yeah, you look at it and you just think,
namaste.
Namaste. That's
Mayan, I feel like you have someone.
I mean, nowhere near the stress level that
no,
Meg will
I mean, Meg
I'm,
pulls
I'm
it
just,
off.
I'm kind of coasting a little bit. no, not really. Not really.
Cut that out
no,
of the pot.
I mean, she just got married. I mean, everything's downhill this year.
Yeah. I think two things. One, just did a massive renovation to the bathroom, the guest bedroom, which everyone here has probably heard me talk about at length, and haven't put a lot of things into the bathroom yet. So I feel like doing some home editing
yes.
will be really, really good. Also, not to plug this show, but I'm really obsessed with trashy reality television shows. And I did see that
seen
tonight.
A trend.
Love is Blind reunion is on. And so maybe I save that for next week. And when I'm in my deepest, you know, darkest time, I turn that on and home edit at the same time.
And light a candle.
I was going to say, that's your candles. Okay.
Yeah.
Gavin, you're just going to lean into the chaos probably.
I never really get stressed, so it's a really hard question to answer.
Correct.
Just always, you know, so optimistic.
Yeah, I've seen you doing a turn on a package for a national radio network at what, 2 in the morning?
Iowa.
Yeah, so
I don't know.
Fever dream.
Yeah not just, pumpkin spice lattes.
Yeah, I had my one annual pumpkin spice latte.
Don't look at
today.
Them.
Very exclusive. Mm. No, just, you know, just staying optimistic. Doom scrolling, you know, it really does help for
I
some
love
reason.
To hear that.
Instagram, I'm just addicted to it. It's unfortunate. I don't
it's a space for us.
Got you.
Watching some Murder She Wrote, maybe.
Oh, yes. Oh,
you know, we're also in soup season and chili season, so maybe I'll just start making some chili.
Another good de-stress tip is Golden Girls reruns.
There you go. Mm.
Yeah. I binged about 4 of those in a row the other day.
We'll come up with some solutions for Tuesday's pod and coping with things and how to survive.
We'll get Marie Kondo.
All right, y'all, that's a wrap from our live taping, but don't worry, in 2025, we will have several more. I'm already planning for one in early January, so get ready, folks. We will let you know when we're going to have those live tapings. But as always, thank you for listening to the pod. You can always show us your appreciation by leaving us a review always on Apple Podcasts or a voicemail at 803-563-7169. And you can always stay up to date with the latest news on SCETV.org and SouthCarolinaPublicRadio.org. And don't forget to support your local newspapers. The South Carolina Lead is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Amy Crouch is our supervising producer. Sean Birch is our executive producer. This podcast is produced with support from PRX and is made possible in part by a grant from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, as well as listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina. For the South Carolina Lead, I'm Gavin Jackson. Be well, South Carolina.
Garen, Darren, Karen, get over here right
Sharon.
Now.
Sharon.
They don't do that. If you knew anything about Aldi, you wouldn't have said
They don't spend money on it.
You wouldn't have said anything like that.